Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find Here Be Monsters now at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, my guest is Joe McGinnis, Jr. He's the author of a new book from Simon & Schuster called Carousel Court, and it really threw me for a loop. I don't expect to bite my knuckles and stay up all night reading. Those are not the kind of books I like. But it's a novel about the dissolution of a marriage. There hasn't been a novel of this kind, this good, I would say, since Richard Yates's famous Revolutionary Road. But unlike Revolutionary Road, it's a thriller. When does this take place? Joe McGinnis, Jr.
Thank you for having me on. To answer your question, it takes place, I would say, around when the mortgage crisis occurred, if we can remember all the way back then, 2008, 2009. Although it's not date specific, because I do believe this works in cycles, and I feel like it could be today or tomorrow or 10 years from now. But it's contemporary.
And primarily in?
Southern California, 40 miles east of Los Angeles.
We've got these two people. They're hot to trot. They're the equivalent of MBAs. They know how to be successful, or rather, they know that there's nothing to be but successful, which is to say that if this man and if this woman can't provide each other with success, they're not going to provide each other with anything else. The marriage is going to fail. The child is going to fail. Their sexual attraction to one another is going to bail out. And sure enough, they're at a point in time where nothing that they do is going to rescue them economically. They come moving out to the vicinity outside Los Angeles. They meant to live on the ocean. They meant to have a beautiful sunlit life, but where do they end up instead?
They end up at ground zero of the mortgage crisis. I mean, they're in a wasteland of abandoned homes, new construction homes, foreclosed homes with neighbors they never intended to live near, some who are burning their possessions in their backyard because they've gone mad.
The banks are coming around to repossess the houses.
Exactly.
And the people, hurt by having been tricked into taking out these loans, which they only have to pay interest on, they're losing their houses, and they say, rather than lose their house, I'm going to destroy the house.
It's taking control over a situation where all control has been stripped away. I kind of don't blame the crazy neighbor for destroying his things, because it's sort of the last thing he can do.
And so there they are, Southern California, home of coyote calls. I have never seen a cicada, but I guess everyone else has. They shriek.
They do shriek.
And they're not.
They don't sting. They don't bite.
They're not like crickets. They're not adorable. They're not. They don't have Jiminy Cricket as a spokesperson.
No, they're not cuddly. But they don't hurt you.
And so all those terrifying near the desert noises of wildcats and cicadas and people shriveling in the heat and realizing they don't really have houses, and they're taking their axe to material things, and this husband and wife who until now have regarded themselves as civilized people.
Yes.
Are caught in the middle of it, trying to figure out what to do without killing each other, except I'd say at a midpoint in the book, killing each other seems viable too.
All bets are off.
All bets are off. Now, yeah, there's a certain kind of quality. People will say Day of the Locust. People will say Joan Didion's Play It As It Lays. And I would say that Joe McGinnis Jr. in Carousel Court has written a book that is a classic Southern California hell novel that can be read, because it's so exciting, in a night or two. You can't stop reading it because these people are you, just a step or two worse than you are. Do you know them?
Absolutely. I went to their weddings. I went to school with them. I worked with them. I feel Nick and Phoebe, they are not safety net people. They don't have anything to fall back on. Their first mortgage wasn't paid for by their parents, so it's not like they're going to cash in at any time. This is their, it's all on them. It's riding on them. They're, I wouldn't say elite educated. They went to fine institutions, Boston University and Emerson to be specific. But they have that nice, young, romanticized belief that when they bring themselves together, they're going to be a strength in numbers, and the world is theirs, and they've got this passion, and they want to see the world and live in the world and conquer the world.
And part of it is that in order to do this, they have to tell each other that they can. And in order to do this, they have to kind of scare each other. Each of them realizes that his or her spouse is a power monger. She squeezes his testicles in bed. He reels and limps as a result. There's a certain level at which the fun in this book is all painful. And we know these people. These are the people who went to school not to get educated, but to get MBAs, to get business savvy, and to learn how to outdo others. Mm-hmm. And if you're like me and you want to see these people get some of their own back, Carousel Court is the novel for you. Did you feel, as a writer, some gleeful misanthropy in watching them drown?
Yeah, look, I have a deep affection for Nick and Phoebe because I understand the impulse, because I understand that there is something at their core in the way they express their love for their son, in the way they do want to protect him. And we can look at them and observe them and watch them and say, my God, you're putting him in so much peril. You're putting yourselves first. What about your child? At the same time, there is a core to them. And I do have some respect for that. On the other hand, there were so many people who sort of did cut corners along the way, whether it started in high school and college, and always expected, though, that they would be rewarded with all the sort of things that they, you know, felt they were entitled to, the wonderful, impressive-sounding job and career, and then the house that looks just picture-perfect, and then vacationing in these wonderful places. And I feel like there's this sort of this sense that they deserve more than they've earned. They're just completely, their sense of themselves is, they deserve what they're getting.
I'm talking to Joe McGinnis Jr. He's the author of a novel called Carousel Court. And you see, it's as if somehow or other, You've taken this marriage and set it inside a pinball machine. And now, you know, the ball is going to bong against the side wall that hits Conopin. She's not going to be happy, Phoebe, unless she has enough Conopin. Mm. This couple, they steal each other's painkillers.
Yeah, yeah. They're in a lot of pain.
They're in a lot of pain, and they live the slightly dulled and simultaneously overcharged life.
Exactly.
She's taking Conopin, but going off representing products for pharmaceutical companies.
Reluctantly.
Reluctantly, yes. But she's got her own schemes for how to do this. She appears to the doctors and seduces them. She pretends that she's going for a gynecological examination, and they're looking inside her as she gives a sales pitch for a new drug. Joan Crawford would have done this in a movie in some crazy way. Where does your affection for these characters come from?
Their ruthlessness and their ingenuity. I mean, these guys are making it up as they go along. They are not, they're not balling up on a couch and just sort of cowering in fear. I mean, the world is crashing down around them, and they are fighting back. These guys are cornered animals, and watch out. And I admire that in some people, as long as they don't go after my son or wife or me.
Nick, on the other hand, you know, they know that they're going to, as they call it, flip this house. They're going to get one of these spurious loans, buy a house, make it so beautiful that they'll be able to sell it like that. Mm-hmm. They make one of those special walls that you
can... The rock climbing wall.
That's right.
Yeah, you got to have one of those if you're just going to really pop.
And an hourglass-shaped pool. Mm. But before long, you see, part of the thrill of this novel is that we're watching the hero literally climbing the walls. It's what he has to do to wear off his tension.
Exactly. And to impress his wife. I mean, he's a show. He's still, you know, still got something.
Okay. Now, has there ever been, to your knowledge, a novel that has turned the viciousness into a thriller? Because that's what you've done. You've made, everything you do, as I say, the pinball metaphor is perfect. No sooner is there an hourglass pool in the backyard than there's no cover for it, and a child who doesn't know better than to fall into it. I mean, everything that can be threatened is threatened, and what's threatened, the threats come from newfangledness, from rock-climbing walls, from hourglass pools, from new drugs to heal pain. They are besieged by the things that the culture has invented to make things beautiful. Is there another novel like this?
I think there's more sort of a nonfiction work, maybe it's just present-day American life. I think your average American is feeling fear of everything. And I think if you look at our current political situation, it's all fear. Fear, fear, fear.
I read novels to allay my fears.
Sorry.
To help me understand a circumstance well enough that I'm no longer afraid. It seems like you wrote this novel to take an intellectual like me, who doesn't read thrillers and doesn't read horror novels, to take a book that's super well written and scare me to death so that I couldn't stop reading it. Now, why did you want to do this to me?
It's climbing Everest. I mean, if I can do that to you, I mean, I no longer need to climb Mount Everest. I mean, this is this is it. I mean, but look, the reality is, this is going to sound super simplistic and it's not very highbrow. So, but I write what I want to read, and there's no reason in the world that something can't have the force of a freight train just going, and then have some emotional heft and weight to it. I mean, I want something to read that just has so much momentum you cannot stop, but at the same time it is moving you like Native Son moved me when I read that when I was 14 years old, or Revolutionary Road moved me when my father gave it to me and I put it off for a decade before reading it. That visceral effect that Less Than Zero and Play It As It Lays had on me in terms of tonal elements that just haunted me and I couldn't get them out of my mind. All of those elements, I'd say those four novels right there formed any sense of that. That's what I wanted to create if I was going to create anything approaching that, and bringing any of those elements together, why shoot for anything less? I'm not saying I got there, but that's what, why not do that? If you can, try.
Now, you mentioned your father giving you Revolutionary Road to read. You're Joe McGinnis Jr. Tell anyone who doesn't know who Joe McGinnis was. He died recently.
Yeah, he was my father. He was a writer, and one of the best writers of nonfiction. He wrote The Selling of the President, sort of introduced the world to Roger Ailes and packaging politicians, and wrote some incredible true crime stories. He basically wrote to rip the facade off of all the sort of the BS that was put forth and we were supposed to sort of swallow whole. And he said, well, hold on, you know, that's all BS, and let me rip it back, pull back the curtain and show you all the ugly stuff going on inside. And he was a warm-hearted, loving, jovial, cynical, brash outsider who crashed the party and still wanted to be celebrated and anointed by the tastemakers, even though he didn't want to go to their cocktail parties and live in New York.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Joe McGinnis Jr. about his book, Carousel Court. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Joe McGinnis Jr. about his latest book, Carousel Court, a thriller about modern marriage and the quest of the middle class for some kind of stability. Instead, they're in Carousel Court. They're on the merry-go-round. There's no escaping until they get a bright idea. The husband, who's working, doing repossessions for the bank, he's emptying out these houses, and he realizes they're sitting vacant. All of these houses, why doesn't he rent them to families who've lost their homes? So he's starting to make money mm-hmm. by misrepresenting mm-hmm. and offering people the kind of hope that the banks have been offering them. You pay me this, it's next to nothing, you can live like a king. And so we watch him become a victim of the perpetration mm-hmm. that he himself mm-hmm. has fallen prey to. Mm-hmm. We used to talk about a certain kind of alienation, which had to do with the failure to express one's inner feelings. These characters are about vacating their inner feelings and then not being able to express their outer feelings either. This really is a book that empties out expressiveness and makes it all into behavior.
I mean, in many ways, they're putting that on hold. They're putting their moral compass and their sort of, okay, let's just put that on, let's pause that, and now we're in survival mode. But Nick wants to salvage this marriage.
He loves her in a form of addictedness.
Yes.
He thinks that her physical beauty is a drug to him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think also as well the sort of the challenge she continues to throw down, she's that, look, you've got to prove yourself to me not once, not twice. You've got to consistently prove yourself to me as worthy of this. And I don't feel like it's done in such a way that you read it and you say, well, come on, my friend, walk away. She's a nightmare. I think there is something he needs that she offers in terms of compelling him forward. I think, like many people, he could fall into a trap of complacency. And there was a passion. It has subsided in terms of his professional outlook, in terms of what he wanted to do. And I think her needling him early on and then going a little bit beyond needling, as we read, is something he almost requires if he's going to, quote unquote, man up and really deliver.
Oh, yeah, that's her expression, man up. The battles, the arguments are truly pungent. These characters, although they're not expressive, they can destroy one another with a phrase. And I think in the realm of, what would you say, gender disability that they're dealing in by the end of this marriage, who's the father? Who's the mother? Who can display tenderness? Tenderness has become for both of them a negative quality, a quality of weakness. Mm. And so, you know, we're watching them develop the language of anti-tenderness together. It's really, by the end of the book, the author has pulled every possible string he can so that these characters can still be talking to one another on the final page of the book, huh?
Or texting.
One or the other. Yeah. The thing that interested me in this kind of novel, usually there's a good guy somewhere on the margins, except for a very nice nanny, a Vietnamese nanny. Mm,
yes.
There's no moral center in this book. There's no one who gives it its ground. So we're really looking at a carousel that's become a spinning top. There's no stopping it.
Right.
It's whirling out of proportion.
Right. I'd like to think that people can handle a story where you don't immediately identify the character you know you're going to root for the whole time. I feel like there's this odd tendency with, I don't know, I don't want to say readers so much as maybe editors or reviewers, and God bless them, but they always got to have that person to root for. The word likability when it comes to characters in fiction. I read a recent review of a novel, and they were talking about the likability of this character or the protagonist, and I kept thinking, my God, have you not seen Goodfellas? I mean, who did you root for In Goodfellas.
Or Breaking Bad.
Yeah, but could you look away? And of course, to bring it back to Revolutionary Road, who did you root for? Who was the...
Yes.
So I think that's such an easy out for people who read these things and want to criticize or take issue with it. Is it a good story? Does it make you want to keep going? Does it give you a feeling that is worth your $26 or $18 or whatever your Amazon Prime rate is? What is it worth it?
Well, I think there is an answer now. This used to be the question in story conferences, in story rooms. Why do we like these characters? Why do we care about what happens to them? And I think that the answer in current times, post, say, The Sopranos, you know, post cable television series, is we don't like them. We want to see how repellent they can become. They're snakes, and they can shed their skins, and who's going to survive?
It's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's riveting. I mean, that's the best. What do you tune in for? I mean, everything has its place, and I think there is room for true-to-life, riveting storytelling that has people we can relate to and identify with, who we're okay taking the ride with them. They're not hurting people along the way, you know, overtly. They're not these odious people. They're not racist and misogynistic, but they're certainly not, you're not gonna, it's like, wow, oh gosh, I hope she makes it. But I just think, man, there's room for it. And I think people do celebrate it, especially with these shows that you mentioned in their certain films. And why not more of that in fiction?
Well, I think you're telling the truth. You said you were affectionate about these characters because of their ruthlessness. And I think in fiction, ruthlessness offers a kind of energy that niceness, goodness, tenderness, sweetheartedness doesn't provide. I think if you want to stay up late reading a book about ruthless people, try Carousel Court by my guest Joe McGinnis Jr. I have been talking with Joe McGinnis Jr., the author of Carousel Court, published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you, Joe, for joining me.
This has been wonderful, and thank you so much, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Carousel Court at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is our producer today. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Chris Lee is our guest.